So welcome everyone to our next installment of our JCC Coffee, Cake, and Learning, The Big Kvetch. So we're going to learn the moment that the Jewish people started to complain. The kvetch means a complaint. When I was a little boy, I remember I used to complain sometimes to my ima, to my late mother, and she would say, David, she would say, there's an official complaint department, lodge your complaint in the complaint department. I say, Ima, where is that complaint department? She said, it's in room 401 on the fourth floor of our house. I said, but Ima, we only have three floors. She said, I think you understand. So that was the kvetch. I was not allowed to complain too much, right? So in fact, there's a cute little story about a boy in Boca Raton. He's walking on the beach with his little dog, Charlie. And as he's walking with Charlie, and thank you, Keith, for giving out the sources, he's walking with his little dog, Charlie, that he loves, and he's trained Charlie. Charlie's a smart little pooch, as you'll hear. And the local rabbi is coming home from early morning minyan from his services, and he wants to show off how great Charlie is. So he says, hi, Rabbi, good morning, you know, Bokir Tov. Rabbi says Bokir Tov to the young man. And then he says to Charlie, Charlie, you ready? And he throws a stick down the sand on the beach, and he turns to Charlie, he says, fetch. Charlie stops in his place. He looks at the stick, looks at the rabbi, looks at the little boy. He says, this is the dumbest game of all time. He goes, every time you do this, it's hot and humid. I know the drill. I'm going to go get the stick, and I'm going to bring it back, and then you're going to throw it back again and again and again. This is ridiculous. Charlie, what's with you, the little boy says. I just said to fetch. Charlie says, oh, I thought you said kvetch. It was good, Lidl, right? The big kvetch. So when did the first little kvetch come? Well, let's look at source one, shall we? The Jewish people have not yet left Egypt. So this is the sections of Torah, the parshios that we're reading about right now. And they came to Moshe, to Moses, in source one, and they asked him, is it because there are no graves in Egypt that you have taken us to die in the desert? What is this that you have done to us to take us out of Egypt? So literally, the people have come out. The Exodus is sort of like halfway complete. But they have an impediment, a raging sea, the Sea of Reeds. The Red Sea is waiting there in front of them that they can't cross right now. And in their frustration and worry, they say basically to God and to Moses, hey, like, why did you even bother if you're going to extinguish us here by the sea? Because remember, the Egyptians, Pharaoh, Yul Brynner, had come with the chariots, and they were ready to annihilate the Jews, and it was only some fire and stuff that kept them at a distance. So already they're kind of kvetchy, but it's a little kvetch, right? It's not a major kvetch. In other words, it's entirely understandable after 116 years of actual servitude, 210 years in Egypt. Everyone thinks it's 430, but the 430 number is actually erroneous. It's a number that takes us back to the original covenant with Abraham, not the time they spent in Egypt land, in Mitzrayim. So it's understandable that you're still a slave, except in reality, you're maybe no longer under the lash, but mentally, in every other meaningful way, you're still a slave. So for them to express frustration or a complaint is, we can give an excuse to them. All right, now let's get to the sea. So the Jewish people are at the sea, and this famous, what's called the Shirat Hayam, the Song of the Sea, it's this week's Torah reading, where we sing, and it's part of our liturgy. If you may love this. I know there are members here, Keith, who has a beautiful way of singing, the Az Yashir Moshe. Then Moses and the Jewish people sang the Song of the Sea, the Shirat Hayam. It's a magnificent piece that's part of our liturgy. Every day we say, right before we get into the serious parts of the morning service, Shacharit, we end with the Az Yashir, and that's the end of what's called Psukei DeZimra, these verses of praise to God. It's the ultimate praise where we sang the song to God. So we, says, source 2, and Israel saw the great hand which the Lord had used upon the Egyptians. And the people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and in Moses, Moshe, his servant. Then Moshe and the children of Israel sang this song to the Lord, and they spoke, saying, I will sing to the Lord. For very exalted is he, a horse and its rider, he cast into the sea. Hey, they rhymed that in English. It's nice. Az Yashir Moshe v'nei Yisrael. So it's a beautiful, beautiful verse. It's coming in this week's parsha. It's a magnificent song. Now, how poignant and profound a moment was this moment. We'll look at source three. This comes to us courtesy of what's called a mechilta. It's a midrash. It's an oral tradition that was given to Moses at Mount Sinai. Some are of lesser import. Some are of more major import. But this is a tradition. Ready? Number three. The most lowly maidservant, a shifcha, just a maidservant, saw at the Sea of Reeds, at the Red Sea, what the prophet Yechezkel, Ezekiel, who would see the vision of the chariot, the Merkava, which was a sign of God, and it was like an incredible vision that Ezekiel had. But the lowliest maidservant saw more than what Ezekiel and all the other prophets, all the other Nevi'im would ever fathom. In other words, the lowest on the pecking order, we're saying, is like a maidservant or a manservant. But even they were intimately aware of the existence of God. But more importantly, as we'll discuss, the how and the why, the mysteries of our world, they had it all at that moment. And they appreciated God and they saw God. And they were on a higher spiritual level, a prophetic level, than even the prophets of the latter days. That's pretty significant. All right. So let's discuss what this means, because I think it's just interesting in its own right. Okay, so let's just take a little time out for a moment. Commercial break for those who are watching at home. Okay. We're not on Zoom, but I'm getting back. Remember when we used to Zoom, it would be nice to have commercial breaks, you know, like the next 10-minute segment before we have a pause will be brought to you by the bagel bar, where you can get your, you know, you can get your delicious hot bagels and cream cheese after class. All right. We'll have to figure out how to do this. Okay. By the way, ever been to a football game?
Yes.
On TV, again, no insult here, they are magnificent. At the stadium? If you could not drink beer, there are just interminable timeouts where you're literally sitting around twiddling your thumb, and it's such a letdown, right? I mean, on TV, it works, because there you can run and get your popcorn and your snacks and bathroom break, etc. But at the stadium, I guess that's why people drink themselves into oblivion, you know, if you've ever been to like an Eagles game, right? All right, Philadelphia, we always like to blame the Eagles. We love the Eagles, but be careful. Right, so be that as it may. What does it mean that the lowest maidservant saw more than a prophet? Like, what does that mean? Moses was the highest ranking member of the Jewish people of all time. Our rabbis explain that he got up to the 49th level. He ascended to the 49th level of understanding of God. He tried to get to the 50th level. And he says to God in the aftermath of the golden calf, he says, Hodienina, please inform me, Esther Achecha, of your ways. Specifically, the question that everyone in Israel, including myself, has asked, especially on October the 7th and the 8th, Tzadik Viralo, why do bad things happen to good people? That's the question. It's the question that we all have on our minds right now. It's a question we had after the Holocaust. It's questions that we have every day. We see people suffer, your loved ones suffer, you may suffer. We say, wait a minute, God, what's going on here? And it can't make sense. So Moses asked, I want to be privy to the insider information. You know what God's answer was? Sorry. Moshe, Moses, you're the best. We love you. I love you. But even you are a human being. And the humanity that you share with every other human being precludes your ability to see the what was, what is, and what will be. God stands outside of time. Mm-hmm. So therefore, by standing outside of time, time is not relevant to his own existence, whatever that means. We're talking conceptually. But when you stand apart from time, then the idea of what was, is, and will be is irrelevant because it's already happened, and yet it hasn't happened. It doesn't mean anything. But when you're constrained by time, in other words, when you're part of the game and you're living in life, think about it. What do we know of the past? Very little. I mean, you have your textbooks, yeah, but even scholars will always revise and debate, you know, Hannibal of Carthage, good guy, bad guy, villain. Again, which perspective are you looking from? If you're Caesar, Maybe Hannibal is a villainous guy of the highest order, right? Maybe for an objective person, you're looking at how Carthage stood up to the Roman Empire. Maybe you're on the other side. I don't know. Are you really going to know just because your history teacher, maybe they were slanted and had a certain perspective. But how would we even know history? It's very difficult. What about the present? Oh my gosh. All the information that we have at our fingertips now, the data that we have, you can't process any of it. And it's half of it is just contradictory. Which way's up? Which way's... You don't know. And then the future, good luck with that one. So that's Moshe's question. I want to know the past, the present, and the future. I want to see. Because only in the context of all those three could I make sense of why bad things happen to good people. In other words, if you don't know the history, then you'll say, well, that's obviously bad. But how do you know what's bad? How do you know what's good? I'll share a quick little story with you. I won't mention names. It happened in our own community. Okay? You all know this person, but I won't mention their name. Just out of, I don't have permission, so I won't mention it. Young man in his early 20s gets his first car, and he's hit by a driver. I think he was drunk or something. The car is demolished. The young man, thank God, was really just shaken up, but thank God he was okay. They brought him to General Hospital, Wilkes-Barre General, just to work him up, make sure concussion, whatever the protocols that the insurance would want. So they took him there to the ER and they did a workup. The radiologist calls the father of this young man about a week after he reads the radiology report for the second time. And he says, you know, everything's good. Thank God your son's well. But I see something I don't like. It's a peripheral image on the x-ray that we did. And there's an actual name for a peripheral image. I don't know what it's called. I remember Dr. Kelman mentioned it because he's a radiologist. So it's, in other words, the focus of the actual x-ray was primarily on this area that he was hit. But there was something off focus, shall we say, that didn't look holy. So he recommended that the young man go back and then have a bunch of workups done on specifically this area where there was a little weird, something there. And they found a fetal growth in the back of his neck, right by his brain stem. Now, it was not cancerous, thank God, but there was a very real possibility that if they wouldn't excise this growth, that it could compress the brain stem and he could become a paraplegic later in life. And the surgery was incredibly difficult. It had never been done. There was a robotic type surgery. You have to go in through the front. I mean, I won't get you into the details, but they did it. It was the first time ever done by this robotics company. And Baruch Hashem, thank God, it was done. The young man's going to live a long and happy life. So here's the question. Let's say I was there at the hospital, at the ER, and he's brought in. His car's totaled. He's emotionally devastated. And I say to the young man, I say, hey, is this good or bad? He would think I'm out of my mind. Was this good or bad? Are you nuts? Of course it's horrible. Let me ask you something. What about after the surgery and the fact that through the x-ray, they found this growth that they would never have located and never had the opportunity to take care of, and he would have lost his life a few years later? How do you feel now? So the context can supply a clarity that in the moment we can't possibly access. So from the God perspective, he already knows the past, the present, and the future, and he understands how complex our world is. He keeps track of each and every one of us in our world, and things that sometimes appear to us as the worst thing in the world conversely become great, and the opposite. Now again, I can't explain to you the hospital, the Holocaust. How could you? It's impossible. You can't judge people. They're greater than we are. We dare not judge. 1.2 million children? What is their crime? We can't, it's inaccessible to us. Again, this is what they saw at the sea. The lowest maidservant, Anna, understood in that moment of absolute blinding clarity. What did they understand at the sea? Why did they suffer in Egypt? It was the first Holocaust on a much smaller scale, but still the Holocaust. Thousands of Jewish baby boys were murdered by Pharaoh, cast into the Nile. The slavery cost so many lives. It was horrific. Mm-hmm. But now that they got to the sea and they passed through the sea and they saw the demise of Pharaoh and they had a vision of the future also, Mount Sinai, the Torah, Israel, the past, the present, and the future all converged in that one searing moment at the sea, so that even the lowest maidservant said, oh my gosh, wow. And what was the only response to God? We got to sing praise to God. And that's why Moses composed extemporaneously this magnificent Shirat HaYam. He was inspired by God to write the Song of the Sea, because that was an expression of, I get it. It all makes sense at that moment, right?
The Song of the Sea, the Miha Mocha by Lee Madonna? Is that
right, right. That's part of it. Okay. Exactly. Okay. Exactly.
I thought Naomi wrote the Song of the Sea.
Naomi? No.
I mean, Miriam.
Miriam. No, Miriam led the women with the tambourines and the dancing. She also sang, Ashir al Hashem, I give my... So she led the women, Moses led the men. There were concurrent songs going on, and the women had a better song than the guys. You know why? Because they had musical instruments. The guys did an a cappella, that's what they call it. They did an a cappella version, sans instruments. But the women brought out the drums, the tambourines, they had a whole orchestra. So here's, because you asked, it's delightful, okay? Okay. So it's the night of Passover. They sit down, they have their Seder, they have their manischef, it's matzah, everything's going well. Next morning, they're desperately packing up the donkeys and getting out of Dodge, because the exile... into the desert has happened. The geula, the redemption is now, and they got to go, right? So boom, boom, boom. So they're packing up whatever belongings that they can muster, and they're leaving behind. They're just jettisoning stuff that's probably very valuable to them, but they have a finite amount of space on Eeyore and Eeyore's friends to carry out. So can you imagine? I know this conversation happened, okay? I know this happened. I know it in my heart, but I can't cite it. Okay, here's the conversation. So the guys, the men are packing it up. The women are busy, you know, with the stuff. Family pictures, okay, whatever. I'm saying it's Egypt, but pretend, right? All right. So they're packing up the donkey. And then the women say, well, you got to make room for my tambourine set, my drum set. And the guys are saying, dear, we've had this conversation with my wife. Okay, I don't understand. I'm throwing away the Bechstein piano, I'm leaving that behind. Well, because a donkey can't carry my Bechstein piano. And I'm leaving behind, like, you know, everything else that really matters to me. Why in the world are you bringing the tambourine? And the best part is, you know what the wife said to the guy? I don't know. Can't explain it to you. But I do know that there will be a moment that I'm going to need the tambourine. And of course, the dutiful husband says, yes, dear, you're right, dear. And again, that conversation must have happened. I promise you, okay? All right. So let's fast forward. They get to the sea. The men sing the song with Moshe, the song of the sea. And then it says, Vatikach Miriam Hanavia et hatuf biyada. The Miriam, the prophetess, sister of Moses and Aaron, took the tambourine. And she led the women in music and dancing. Okay. And they sang to God. So what did they have, like Abe's musical rental shop there by the Red Sea? So the rabbis say, whoa, where did the musical instruments come from? They brought them out. We just talked about it. So can you imagine the women, and it's a women thing. We have a word for it. It's called Bina Yetera, this sort of extrasensory understanding of what's going to be, even if you can't articulate what's going to be. Women always know the future. So they don't know specifically, but they knew, I need the drum kit. For what purpose? Can't help you there. And I remember having this conversation multiple times in my lifetime with my mom, a blessed memory, and my wife. And she just says, divest yourself from this situation you're in. And I said, can you tell me why? I appreciate it. I'm going to listen to you, dear. Can you articulate to me why I need to get out of this situation? She said, no, it's going to end poorly. That's all I know. And guess what? It always would have ended poorly, but I divested myself. So this is unique, right? This is unique. And I have an analogy, by the way. Here's my analogy. Are we familiar with chess? Okay, so chess is the most brilliant game ever constructed, right? Brilliant, beyond words. So let's suppose you had the greatest chess matches of all time. I think they're still considered widely the greatest chess matches of all time were between Garry Kasparov and Anatoly Karpov, a couple of Russians. Kasparov at that moment was the greatest chess player who ever lived. I think Carlsen has surpassed him in the rating. But It was Kasparov and Karpov, and they played a bunch of games. So let's suppose, just for a moment, you had access to the game, and Karpov and Kasparov are across the table from each other, and they're playing the world championship game, and you take a timeout. You say, Gary, you say to Gary Kasparov, could you please explain to me, why did you just make that last move? You moved your pawn to queen four. Why did you do that? So Gary would think for a second, he'd look at you, and he would say, I can't explain it to you. It would take me from now till next Tuesday to try to give you the permutations of the possibilities of the millions of moves that could or should take place if I had to do it scientifically for you. I would need a supercomputer. I would need AI, artificial intelligence, and maybe then it would be a stressful thing. But then Gary would say to me, this is the women's idea. Even though I can't tell you specifically why, I know that if I don't make this move, in 16 moves, checkmate. I can't explain it to you because that's not the nature of the game. But I'm Gary Kasparov, and I'm a master. And I know that if I don't make this move, intuitively, I know this is going to happen. Finished. So that is what the ladies had. That's why they had the tambourines, and that's why they had the beautiful Song of the Sea. Yeah? See? We went off on a little tangent there, but I think that was fun, right? Let's get back to the kvetch. So, at the moment of the sea, they had an unbelievable, unprecedented vision, an intimate relationship with God. And yet, it didn't take a long time for the Jewish people to somehow start to kvetch and to question things. You know how long it took? 3 days. 3 days from the sea. It says, they went a three-day journey into the midbar, into the wilderness, but they couldn't find any water. And then they came to a place that became known as Mara. So if you're into Passover and you like your maror, the bitter herbs, the word mar means bitter. They came to a place called Bitter Waters. Probably didn't have a name beforehand, but then it became known as Bitter Waters because the waters were undrinkable. They looked beautiful. It looked like a beautiful Poland Springs day, but the people can't drink it. So what did they do? They started to kvetch. Let's look at the kvetch. Number four, the people complained against Moshe saying, what shall we drink? Okay, stop. So the construct of our Torah reading is incredible. This is not my own insights, my teacher, Rabbi Weinberg. Every parsha has a certain amount, every section of the Torah that we read on the Sabbath, on Shabbat, has a certain amount of verses. Art Scroll at the very end of each parsha likes to give you how many verses there were, just so you can preemptively get in and say, oh my gosh, I got 137 verses to get through, you know? Or yay, it's only 81 this week. Okay, so Bishalach, this parsha that has the Song of the Sea and the kvetching, the complaining, it has 116 verses. 116 psukim. What is incredible is that the parsha is divided 58 and 58. 50%, literally, 58 verses take you from the beginning of the reading through the Red Sea, through the Song of the Sea, and that's 58. And then the last 58 take you from verse 59 to verse 116, so it's literally 50-50, and they take you from the sea to the end of the section. Now, if I was without knowledge of what really happened, I would say, wait a minute. So the construct should be like this. They leave Egypt, and they leave down here because they're slaves, and there's an elevation happening, a curve. And that elevation is taking them up in terms of spiritual awareness, love of God, and it reaches its apex with the Song of the Sea, obviously, because at that moment, everybody bought into God. So that's easy, right? It goes like this. Now, what should the rest of the last 58 look like? Well, I would think, okay, you can't match the Song of the Sea because that's a moment that is defined by the moment and will never be replicated, okay? But minimally, maybe it should go like this a little bit. There'd be a little bit of a downhill curve, kind of like this. No, it's like this. You go up, you hit the Song of the Sea, and from every verse down, they go downhill until literally the end of our section of our parsha. The Jewish people out loud say, is God among us or not? So you think about an astounding declaration. You go from the maidservant understands more than Ezekiel. So you're at the apex, the zenith of Jewish history, of belief. I believe in the most profound way in human and Jewish history possible. And then you go from there to, where's God? Huh? Does God even exist? Like, what's going on? How is this possible? So I'm going to make a statement, and then we're going to follow through on the statement. Miracles do not create faith. Au contraire, miracles destroy faith. Faith creates a miracle. But miracles can destroy faith. Now, why that will be, that's what we're going to discuss right now. Mm-hmm. But let's get to the more complaints. Okay, ready? Next complaint, please. Source number 5. So now we get to the real complaint, where the entire community of Israel complained against Moshe, against Aaron, and they said, if only we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by pots of meat, when we ate bread to our fill, for you have brought us out into this desert to starve this entire congregation to death. Now, what is insane about that statement is it's baloney. So they're thinking, or they're articulating out loud, oh, when we were in Egypt, we were slaves. We just lollygagged. We just luxuriated in our lazy boy recliners while Pharaoh's taskmasters brought us barbecue, and we sat there with our beer and our barbecue watching the Eagles and Giants, and it was fun. Really? That's your memory? So you talk about like a fake out, a false memory. But it's so insulting, because it's one thing just to say, hey, I'm hungry. That's different. I'm hungry, what am I going to have to eat? There's no Wise Market or Food Giant or Wegmans here in the desert. What am I going to do? That's understandable. We live in a place that's tohu vavohu, desolation itself. What am I going to eat? That's not a complaint. That's like I'm voicing a concern. Where's my food going to come? And the answer is manna from heaven. That's going to be the response to this, even with the complaint. The manna from heaven's going to come. But to create a false narrative and ascribe the hundreds of years of slavery as if we sat luxuriously eating a bunch of meat and having fine wine, it's just baloney. So how painful must that be if you're God to receive that? Like to even hear the words out loud that are just a lie? They're baloney? Kosher baloney, but they're not Oscar Mayer. So the question is, what's going on? So you see, 3 days, they get to the bitter waters. They complain, what are we going to drink? God helps them, they have water. Then they go journey a little bit more, and they're hungry. But instead of just saying, hey, I'm hungry, what's to eat? No. I remember the great luxuries of Egypt. And what did you do, God? You brought us out of Egypt just to starve us to death? I mean, how vicious is that? Mm-hmm. Right? It's not enough to kvetch, but boy, that's the real kvetching. Okay, next. The number 6. Now we get to the end of our Torah reading. This is the part where they come to a place called Rephidim. And in Rephidim, it really got bad. This is the bottoming out, if you will, of their kvetch. This is where, ready? The people quarreled with Moshe, and they said, give us water that we may drink. Moses said to them, why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test God the Lord? The people thirsted there for water, and the people complained against Moses. And they said, why have you brought us up from Egypt to make me and my children and my livestock die of thirst? Moshe cried out to the Lord and said, hey, what shall I do for this people? A little longer, od me'at uskaluni. They will stone me. They'll kill me. They're crazy. They're insane. And then, as a response to this, he, God and Moshe, named this place Massah, testing of God, and Meriva, arguing, quarreling, kvetching with God because of the quarrel of the children of Israel and because they're testing the Lord, saying out loud, is the Lord in our midst or not? Hayesh Hashem dekirbenu im ayin. And that was the ultimate indignity, the idea that they could dare ask. All right, now this is, tragically, the very first appearance of a nation that you all know about, because we have a holiday called Purim. This is where Amalek, who are the spiritual ancestors, the physical ancestors of Haman, of most likely Hitler and the Nazis, and I don't know, maybe Hamas is there too. But they're right there, and they make their first appearance right here at the sea. They sensed that all was not well within the united camp of Israel, because the people weren't united. And whenever we're not united, the enemies of Israel kind of sense. They're kind of like a rabid dog that smells a weakness and tries to perpetuate that moment into villainy. And that's what they did. So what did they do? Amalek comes and they attack. But who did they attack? Did they attack the men, the forces of the army potentially? No. They did what all cowards do, what Hamas did. They attacked the women, children, the old, the infirmed. Kohanecha shalim acharecha. Anyone who was like cast out of the protective cloud, couldn't keep up, they attack them. And then Joshua gets the army and Moses prays and they vanquish Amalek on that day. But God said, it's not over today. Yeah, you took care of Amalek today, but there's an eternal battle against Amalek. And these were the words that our Prime Minister, Bibi Netanyahu, talked about after the Hamas attack on October 7th. And he was misquoted diabolically by South Africa, who tried to claim, oh, well, you're going to commit genocide because the Amalekites, men, women, and children, were supposed to be wiped out. But that was not the quote that Netanyahu quoted. He quoted the verses that we say before Purim on that Sabbath, where we say, no, an eternal war between God and the Jewish people against Amalek. It doesn't mention anything about who or what, the particulars of the war, just that there will be a war to vanquish Amalek. That's all. So all he was saying is that when you attack and do what you did on October 7th, I'm equating it to what Amalek did by attacking the men, women, and children. No more and no less. And yet South Africa brought us, and they're bringing us, I don't think they've decided, at the World Court at The Hague, they brought us up trying to commit genocide. Now let me just defend Israel for a moment, just as a side, because you need to hear this. I don't know if this is current, but I read last week that 165 countries in the world did not agree with the South African position that Israel was committing genocide against the people of Gaza. And on that list, we're very friendly to Israel countries. I'm being sarcastic. Russia, China, North Korea. The only countries really that agreed were the Arab Muslim countries in the area. Maybe that was just for expedience sake for their own population. I'm sure Egypt probably privately doesn't agree, but they have to publicly agree because their population. Okay. The best part. Germany out loud announced, we will defend Israel against the accusation of genocide. How delicious is that? Germany gets up at The Hague and says, we know genocide because we genocide 6 million Jews. Right. This ain't genocide. And we're going to bring truth to the lie and we will defend Israel. I mean, how beautiful is that, that Germany would step up? And how just devoid of any humanity must the people on the court be not to just summarily throw this case out without any merit? When you have Germany coming to defend Israel's position, you would think that they would step back and say, you know what, this is garbage and this is nonsense and this is just defamatory. We're not going to go there. Just as a little aside, because I think it relates, because that's Amalek. Germany was Amalek during World War II without question. They killed everybody. So that's Amalek, and that's their attack. So why did we get subject to the attack? Remember we talked about context at the beginning and the why and the where? Because we said, is God with us or not? So if you want to ask if God is with us or not, then God says, well, I guess I'm not. If you have to ask the question, it's a rhetorical question. Where would I be but in your heart and in your soul? And if you don't make a place for me in your heart and soul, then I guess I'm not with you. And if I'm not with you, guess who could win a day against you? Haman, Amalek. So it's not a coincidence that they show up at this moment. So the analogy they give the rabbis is a father who carries his son on his shoulders. Little boy, kind of spoiled. And everywhere he goes, the little boy says, Abba, Abba, Dad, can you buy that for me? Can you buy that for me? Can you download that for me? I'm using a little vernacular. Yes, of course, son. Of course, son. He buys everything the little kid wants. He protects the little kid, literally carrying him on his shoulders. And then one day, dad, little boy on the shoulders, and they're walking down a road, and an older stranger comes by, and the little boy reaches over his dad, and he says to the stranger, "Hey, have you seen my father? I'm missing him." The stranger goes away. The father takes the little boy off his shoulders, puts him down, and he says, "Where is your father? I have carried you on a wing of eagles." This is God, obviously, speaking to us. "I've taken care of you. I've given you manna. I've given you everything you ever wanted, protection, food, drink. I destroyed Egypt to release you from slavery. Everything I've done for you. And you dare, you have the chutzpah, the audacity to ask, where am I? Oh, you'll remember." And at that moment, a ferocious pit bull came. I'm just making the dog species up because they're pretty ferocious. And when the dog threatened the young boy yelled, "Abba, Abba, Dad, Dad, please come save me." Amalek in the analogy is the pit bull. And then when Amalek comes, we cry out and we remember where God is. All along, he's been there for us. So that's sort of the long and end of it. So how did we get to that point? By complaining, by kvetching. So let's get back to our original question, okay? How is it possible to go from "I believe in God" at the sea, the lowest maidservant appreciates God and sees God, 3 days, we're complaining, water, then we're complaining about food, and then water again. It's a downward spiral that has unfortunately never really gone away amongst the Jewish people, unfortunately, tragically, right? But how do you go from there? And we said that the working idea is that miracles are created by faith, but the miracle sometimes can destroy faith at the same time. So let's look at number 8. Moses knew all along, Moshe knew, that belief based on miracles leaves people wary and doubtful. And that is why he was so reluctant to accept the mission of going to Pharaoh. This is from Maimonides, the Rambam. Beautiful quote, amazing quote. So why would that be though? Why would a miracle crush rather than elevate one's faith? So let me give you a couple of approaches, okay? The first approach would be this. If you're a thinking person, what is a miracle? So God is interjecting himself actively in nature, in life. So things will work out the way he wants. But the 99.9% of the time that you don't see the hand of God reaching into your life or the lives of everyone, where exactly is God? So I would say to you that it's possible to see that only when God is active in a miracle way, okay, God's active in the world. But when he's not, he's like an absentee landlord. He's not visible to me. And that was the question that Jewish people asked. They didn't say, is God existing? No. He said, is God with us or not? It's a different question. It's not the existence of God. Rather, is God actively engaged in my life? Is he among us? And of course, that's rhetorical, because if you ask the question, the answer is no, because you got to make room for God in your heart. That's part of our end of the bargain, that we have to make room for God and include God. That's the whole point. It's a reciprocal covenant, a bris. Okay, that's one approach. Second approach is that miracles can become ordinary. So the first time that the manna appeared magically at the tents of the Jewish people, so they're in the desert, and they're told that if you're a tzaddik, if you're a righteous person, you will simply open up your tent, the manna will be there. The manna was wrapped bottom and top in dew, a thin layer of dew to protect it from insects and filth. And they would go outside, and their Wall Street Journal would be right there. I would have said New York Times, but not anymore. I'm sorry. Sorry. The Wall Street Journal's there. They're USA Today. I don't know if they even publish that anymore. I used to love the USA Today. Once upon a time, best sports section of all time. The USA Today or Canaan Today, Wall Street Journal, and their manna was there. And it was a portion for every member of the household, and it was warm, and it could taste like anything in the world. So the first day that this happened, the Jewish people were blown away by God's love. The warmth that they felt in the manna was the warmth of God's love for them. And then I'm sure day 2, again, By the time they got to Friday, they were a little worried. Well, what's going to happen with Shabbat? They were told there'll be a double portion. That's why we have two challahs Friday night. There'll be a double portion that will fall Friday, one for eating on Friday, one for eating on Saturday for the Sabbath. Okay, beautiful. But let me ask you, after a couple months of manna, it just becomes wallpaper. You collect your paper, you collect your manna, finished. You don't think about, wow, this is food from heaven and it can taste like anything I want, right? It's just de rigueur. It's just lost. So what happens is we as humans have an unbelievable, unending appetite to just get used to anything. And that could be the greatest thing when you're in a tough situation, when you're living with pain or sorrow. You can adapt and get used to it. It's a gift from God. But that same gift comes with a dark side. That in the same way I can get used to living in Auschwitz. Jews lived in Auschwitz. They survived Auschwitz. And you speak to them. How could you survive hell on earth? That was the adaptability that human beings have been given. They could survive. But that same love, that gift that God gave us to adapt to even the most difficult, painful situations, there's a dark side. We can get used to good things also and take things for granted. We can take our loved ones for granted. We can take God for granted. So I would dare say that that also eliminates miracles. So as great as the miracle is today, in the rearview mirror, the inspiration of the sea was great in that moment. Oh my gosh, that was a month ago. That was 3 weeks ago. That was 6 months ago. You can't immortalize the fleeting moment unless you do something active to immortalize it. So that's human nature, that the moment of inspiration, if you don't seize that moment and do something to define the moment and to change, then that moment is lost. So yes, the maidservant was wonderful for that moment. She didn't do anything to incorporate that moment into her belief system. So going forward, I'm sure there were many Jews, men and women, who use the moment as a moment to propel themselves to greater things. Moses, Aaron, Miriam, etc. And there were others who, okay, in the moment they were better than Ezekiel. But 2 days later they weren't better than Ezekiel because the moment was fleeting. It was gone. So let's end with the following. Rather than get on a dour note, let's just end with the idea of nature. Just very briefly. God is nature. And by creating nature in such a perfect way, he hid himself within the confines of nature. So we will ascribe the most amazing things. We'll say, oh, well, that's just part of the way the world works. Yeah, really? Talk to a doctor, someone who's cut open a human body and seen how frail a human being is. And you say, what's the default position? I promise you, it's not good health and long life. We are shielded, the seven layers of your skin, for example, cloud your judgment into believing that we're invincible because we don't see the circulatory system in action. We don't see all the magic that every moment of every... Can you imagine how crazy we would all be? We would be lunatics. We'd be looking in the mirror. If you could see your inner workings of your body or just the circulatory system alone, can you imagine to be looking, oh, wait a minute, dear, come here. Do you see that little thing? Is that, did I have that yesterday? Or, right? So it's just a fake out. We fake ourselves out. We wear clothing. We have the seven layers of skin as clothing. We don't see how frail a human being is and how reliant we are every moment of every day for God's mercy and love, or we wouldn't be here. And how the default position is not life. It's the opposite. So that is a miracle. And yet, within science and medicine and nature and all the brilliance of people over the years, we have such an intimate understanding of the subatomic and atomic particles and molecular nature of the world that we believe, oh, it's just nature. Come on. That's God. But yet, he's hidden within the confines of nature. And therefore, that's a very big challenge for us to try to understand and to attribute. And I'll just leave you with this thought. When somebody is lacking something and then it's restored to you, and I've been there, you've probably all been there at least once in your lives. I'll give you an example. I was once in a hospital right before Tisha B'Av. I had a bunch of MRIs with contrast, without contrast. They thought, God forbid, I was having a stroke. It was simply a Lyme disease situation. Okay. So I remember lying in my bed in the hospital. As a rabbi, I visited a whole lot of people in the hospital, unfortunately. That's just part of it. But fortunately also, because it's a great thing for me too, to be able, it's an honor It lifts me up. But I'd never been on the receiving end, not once. My wife comes after she drops our little boy, Tully, a little time, is going to like daycare or whatever. She comes by the hospital, the Vassar Brothers Hospital in Poughkeepsie. And I was literally lying in bed and I couldn't get up. To see her face, to see someone who loves me come in to see me, blew me away. Because here I am, and I realize I don't have that perspective. I'm visiting, I'm not on the receiving end. And in that moment, it was shattering to me, because I realized, oh my gosh, here you do Bikur Cholim, and everyone talks about how wonderful it is to visit someone who's ill. You don't really know how wonderful it is to visit someone. And in that visit, words are not even important. Just your presence and your love, by you being there bedside, it's life-altering. So in that moment, I had an insight. And again, I lost the insight, or I just took it for granted because I don't appreciate it. But in that moment of inspiration, I realized it changed the way I look, my perspective of who I am and what I do and how I live my life and what it would mean going forward. So that's my Red Sea moment, if you will, for me. But how do you make that? How do you incorporate that into every day? And how do you keep that excitement and that novelty? Because it gets worn out. No matter how inspirational the moment is, it gets lost. The manna, three, 4 months into the manna falling, it's just manna. What's the big deal, right? So I guess what I'm trying to say is maybe in the absence of things in our lives, we take precious accounting of all the friends we have around our table. How beautiful it is to have a Torah class on a Thursday at the JCC and have you all with us. Just a few months ago, Mrs. Cooper was sitting right here with us, Charlotte, Alel Shalom, right? Cutler, I'm sorry, I knew that. Charlotte Cutler, Alel Shalom, was sitting right here, okay? She's not here with us. So how precious was that moment to have Charlotte with us? Again, right? So that's my bracha to you, is that we should all, in the moment, the blessing is that we should retain ownership over those mana moments in our lives, the miracles that God does, both big and small, and have that appreciation for what it means to be part of life itself. I wish everyone a wonderful day.